Welcome to Dawn's Sunday Night Diorama. It's Sunday, 17th of March, 2013, and I'm happy to have international lawyer and activist Alexander Penley back on the show. Alexander has bravely agreed to talk about his illegal arrest and particularly harrowing first-hand experience of police brutality because of being an international lawyer for Occupy. He'll also be discussing the events leading up to the events during and those that took place in the aftermath of his illegal arrest. There are videos relating to Alexander's time at Occupy Wall Street on his YouTube account, youtube.com/revelesque, and that's on the website anyway, the darkcityradio.com website. You can find that under guests. He also has his own law firm, PenleyGlobalLaw.com, and you can find him on Facebook under Alexander Penley. If we have time, we'll play by ear. If we have time in the second half of the show, I may open the phone lines for anyone who has had similar personal experience of police brutality to share their stories. So basically, you would have to Skype Bob's backyard, or you could call the landline. If you're from the UK, it's 0161 298 0298. And if you're calling from international, it's 0044 0161 298 0298. If the system turns away from the abuses inflicted on the guilty, then who can be next but the innocents? It's a quote by Michael Connolly. It's happening right now. It's not just on film. It's not being recorded. As another quote by Rodney King, "The love of liberty is a love of others. The love of power is a love of ourselves." William Hazlitt. Now, I first wish to clarify that this show is not aimed at bashing all police. It's rather aimed at exposing bad behaviour and abuse of power of some police officers of the law, in particular of those who choose to participate in police brutality when in such a position where they take an oath to serve and protect the public, yet they're breaking this oath, and it begs the question, just who are they really serving and trying to protect? As is the case when a police officer is attacked, quite often the punishment is severe because it was a cop who was the victim. However, those responsible for perpetrating police brutality have on numerous occasions got off with no action taken against them. Amadou Diallo's case is a prime example. Amadou was a 22-year-old immigrant from Guinea, and he was shot at 41 times and killed with 19 bullets by members of the New York Police Department's Street Crime Unit. He was unarmed, and you can search a Jill Nelson police brutality book and that'll come up. Police brutality attacks are one of the greatest dangers to the public at large and are still very much a problem worldwide to this day. Should it not stand to reason that anyone proven guilty of such crimes should be held accountable for any such power abuses? Alexander, I'd like you to welcome you to the show again. It's a pleasure to have you back, and considering it's going to be quite a harrowing thing for you to discuss, thank you for coming on here, and I'm happy to give you this platform to get information out that really needs to be, some light needs to be shown on it. So how are you?
I'm doing all right.
That's
I'm
good.
happy to be back on the show. And yeah, I mean, I'm basically with the things I want to talk about tonight, I think that, this is hopefully part of a start because I think it's something that should be in the media everywhere, basically, because it's pretty intense. And the one thing you said about individual police, with regard to the New York City Police Department, I have to really question actually anybody who stays on the New York City Police Department for more than a couple, 3 years. In the beginning, they can say, oh, they want to do good, blah, blah, blah. And maybe you're a bit naive. But once they see the everyday working of the New York City Police Department, I really have to question all of them because they stay there and they perpetuate whether or not they are actually abusing it. They are involved deeply in the system of abuse. And that's, basically. And as a whole, the New York City Police Department are tend to be, and by their interaction and continuing to get their paycheck and be cops, those other people as well, are basically, it seems that they are wannabe gangsters who couldn't get into real mafia, who couldn't get into whatever, and so went for the street hoodlum side, which that's what the NYPD tend to be and are, is street hoodlums. And basically, in that context, it's very difficult to say that any individual who would stay and look at that day in, day out would not have a lot of blood on their hands, or, you know, as well.
Okay, I hear you. So, can we start at the very beginning? Can we go back in time and can you tell us a bit about yourself and your story? How, for example, how you got involved in activism and practicing law?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've been an activist since I was in high school. 25 years ago, I graduated. So basically fought for justice and freedom and on a lot of things, including prisoner rights, including earth and animal liberation. And a lot of it, I got involved with Occupy from the first day because it really drove the point home that all of the other problems that we're having have to do with the rich owning everything and performing everything for their profits and not caring about people and anything at all, you know, whatsoever. And the idea of, you know, yeah, you might have stolen our world, but we're having it because it's all of our world. And we're going to occupy it if you won't admit to reality, which is it belongs to all of us and not just to you. So I, from the first day, did a lot of legal work for just on the street for Occupy, both well in New York City as well as Washington D.C., Albany, New York, Newark, New Jersey. I was also in Oakland, California with Occupy. Basically, yeah, and I've helped on the internet for occupiers all over the world. And within New York, I was primarily, more than anything, serving as liaison with the police because I know the New York City police. I don't trust them. And I didn't trust them to not murder people, frankly. And I felt that even if they were wrongfully arresting people, keeping people at Occupy rather calm about everything would do the best so that individuals wouldn't be killed or brutally beaten. So, for example, when they started making placards for, you know, for protests, for, you know, signs and all that, it started, tons of people made signs. And within the park, it started taking over a good percentage of the park with where the signs were laid out. And I saw a lieutenant speaking to some of the people who were making signs. And I asked him, you know, what could be, you know, what does he need? Right. And basically, at that point, he told me that, you know, the signs are expanding exponentially and people aren't going to be able to walk through the park. And I said, that's fair enough. You know, you see where it is now. We'll do our best to keep it within that. I'll tell them, you know, whatever. So I could speak to the occupiers and they don't have to deal with the police lieutenant. They can actually deal with one of them. And even at that point, he mentioned about, you know, when the garbage is taken out at night so that we could get, you know, our garbage ready by that point. You know, so it was friendly enough. You know, and things like that. I was doing, you know, just doing all I can to make sure that the police stayed rather calm, because I could tell that, you know, when they're arresting people for chalking on the sidewalk and crap, people were getting very angry. And as a group, if there's, you know, 20,000 people getting very angry, well, then there is a decent chance for them to have equal leverage with the police. But on an individual level, the police will just kill them. So, yeah. And so, you know, basically the police, a lot of them knew who I was and would go to me to say, you know, whatever the, you know, things for, you know, we want to make sure that they know this is going on. All right, cool. You know, and I would, and I got to a point where I could actually ask them, well, are you planning on any arrests today? And stuff like that. So that, you know, people could feel more calm and comfortable being
there. That must have been quite stressful.
Yeah, it was, yeah. And there was a lot of abuse going on despite what I was doing. So, yeah, it was very stressful. In fact, actually, when I went up to Occupy Albany with three other people, we were all smoking. And all of us had quit for years previous to Occupy. But because of the day-to-day stress, four of us in a car, after years of not smoking, had started again. So, yeah, it was stressful.
Yeah, I can imagine. As a lawyer, did you feel that this, that it was easier to be taken seriously by people, by the protesters, by some of the police, or as you said, like none of the police were? Did you feel that none of the police were taking you seriously?
I was singled out, because I was in my rights to videotape things and things like that. So I got punched with somebody's camera. There's a team that does videotaping, because of good work of previous lawyers, they're not allowed to unless there's an imminent felony going on. But they were they're called the TAC team, and they were always there. And I went up and I asked one of the officers with the camera, you know, what are you doing here? All right, you're not supposed to be videotaping, and you're well aware of that. And he punched me with his camera. That was months before anything else happened. That was, I don't know, like February or something like that, of the year after it started. So, yeah, there was that level. A lot of the beat cops who were there, just the standard police, more than anything were bored. Because they had so many there, and there was nothing to do, because there wasn't, you know, violent confrontation, whatever. It was, you know, people who would have protests and, you know, have workshops, and, you know, so it was over. They were bored to tears, you know, because they would just be standing there, a lot of them, for their entire shift.
Did you find also, like, apart from to do with the cops, but to do with the protesters, did you find being a lawyer sometimes worked against you? I suppose, like you said, with that other guy punching you, did you find any other incidents where it was that you weren't being taken seriously because some people might have some preconceptions about what a lawyer does or believes in? Or
I got some of that, but they all saw what I was doing pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. Other occupants, so they were happy to have me there, and I also became part of the media team, so I wasn't just being a lawyer completely, you know, I was also helping with a lot of other things and helping with setup and, you know, food distribution, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and people saw that, and, you know, yeah, it was definitely appreciated. I think that, the only issue I found was that some of the, let's see, I have one problem with some of the occupiers who told me, oh, we decided by, they were calling consensus. Somebody got in and destroyed consensus from the beginning. So they called it a 90% consensus, which isn't consensus. Consensus is agreement. So they started democracy or, you know, majority rules, whatever, oriented quote-unquote consensus that had nothing to do with consensus. And at one point, I remember somebody telling me, you know, oh, well, you know, we decided nobody can talk to the police. And I'm like, well, yeah, I don't think you all should, but there's a reason why I am. And a lot of the other occupiers were, you know, right pissed off about that. But why the hell would you not want him to speak? You know, because the reason I was speaking and also speaking to the media was because they couldn't really twist my words. And I'm not going to say something to them which I shouldn't be saying. You know, and I know how to speak to these people in a way that is not, you know, if a layperson speaks to the police, often they will say something that somehow may be construed as illegal. Or some of the people who were even interviewed by the media sounded like idiots. You know, I'm not saying everybody. A lot of people were incredibly articulate. but you know, what is this all about? Like, dude, it's about boom. You know, like, what did you just say? You know, or people would talk to the cops and like, oh yeah, man, did you see that? We broke some good windows. You know, whatever. I don't know. And the police, you know, part of it was not only beat cops, I actually outed some people, some officers, I believe, who were undercover police within Occupy.
Right.
Yeah. I started letting through these individuals. Well, you know, I've actually done the same on Facebook before, where all of a sudden somebody turns the discussion toward in a direction that's like, wait a minute. Nobody would actually start talking like that unless, you know, so I start asking some follow-up questions and find out. For example, there was one woman there at Occupy who said, you know, we have to admit we all have to follow the blue line. And there's a term in the United States of following the thin blue line, right, which is a terminology which means that you have to follow the police code. And I'm not talking the legal code, just the way the police run things, you know? And you can't go against that. Nobody says that outside of police. Nobody. Not criminal, not anybody. Somebody starts talking thin blue line, you know who they're likely working for. I found out more about her family, and she wasn't related to police. So, like, that's it. No. You don't just come up with terminology like that. And she wasn't saying it tongue-in-cheek. You know, okay, I understand because you know that police will speak a certain way. If you're speaking a certain way that, you know, you can say it sarcastically, whatever. No, it was nothing like that. She didn't grow up with police, according to what she told people about her family. And it was obvious at that point. You know, and I was with a friend of mine who was also an older activist, and, you know, he's been around much longer than I have. And both of us agreed. And we're shocked because we heard that and we're like, wait a minute. You know, but sometimes they will slip up. Even if they're deep undercover, they'll say something which comes from their culture that becomes obvious. But things like that was, you know, it was valuable to have somebody with their, you know, ears to the wall and knowing who's who, you know, because we had a lot of infiltration, not just from police. I was also keeping it focused. Because there were communist and socialist groups that were trying to overtake it. The Democratic Party definitely had individuals in there who were purporting to be occupiers, but were trying to steer it all around to how the Democrats are going to save us somehow. And, you know, it's like the Labor Party going into, you know, Occupy Stock Exchange and just feeling like, yeah, man, it's all Tories because the Labor...
It's really just like a false left-right paradigm, though. They're both controlled by the same puppet masters, whether it's in America, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans. And in the UK, in our case, it's like the Tories and the Lib Dems have become the con Dems, basically, against Labour. So we've got the same thing going on over here as well.
Right. It's basically like within Europe, you have there are some countries where at least you have the Pirate Party. And the Pirate Party actually tends to be pretty cool. But outside of that, it seems like all political parties are pretty darn close to the same thing. And even if they do have some good views, they're so mired in the bureaucracy that there's no way they can ever get them done. So, you know, and in this country, if somebody who was different were to become president, if they weren't killed, they just wouldn't. They would be, you know, so they would be stopped. They just wouldn't be allowed to pass anything. You know, Jimmy Carter, who was president in the 70s, said before he left
that if they weren't.
You know, he made a public address and said, I just want you Americans to know that the president can't really do a damn thing. You know, and I thought that's telling. And it's accurate. You know, it's part of how the structure is set up so that within the boundaries of. The system itself, anything that's too far outside of that is doomed to failure because it will run up against something else which will counter it and it will fall to pieces. Yeah.
I think we should get down to the nitty-gritty here and go into the events leading up to. I know you went through a really negative personal experience relating to the cops Occupy. Could you maybe talk about the events leading up to that and then what actually happened?
Yeah, sure. It was there was an anarchist book fair, and as I have, and it's not all anarchists who are at the book fair. There's a lot of, for example, the rights of indigenous people groups and environmental groups, radical environmental groups, etc., that are at this thing. So I went because I have some clients there and friends too, a lot of friends there. So after this, there was to be a march against the police of New York and their lovely treatment of citizens, well, regardless of citizens, people in the United States, and New York. And I went on this march. Basically, they brutalized one person on the march. There was some tussle with the police. I know that the individual who was brutalized by them, I don't know what actually happened. Whether they finally dropped it, I'm not sure, but I know that they were trying to charge him for breaking a window, which was never broken. Well, regardless, this protest ended, and it kind of just ended. And hours later, there was a after party for people involved with the book fair. Okay, and I went to that after party with a friend of mine, and we hadn't gone in yet. We were sitting on the stairs outside a community center, and while we were sitting on the stairs, 10 later found out were officers, 10 individuals with the same haircuts with really cheap looking suits on, marched up the street. And turned in front of my friend and started, again, we were both sitting down and started kicking him and hitting him. And the way they were dressed,
What?
the way they were dressed made me think they were police. Because usually you don't have people with the same haircuts and cheap suits and 10 of them together marching in military fashion who are not police. It's kind of weird, you know? And so I
Okay.
said, I said I'm an international lawyer, and what's going on? And just like that, I didn't say, "Hey, buddy," I mean, nothing like that. Just I'm an international lawyer, and what's going on? They're hoping to stop the, attack, basically, and hoping, I don't know, they'd run away. Okay, they got their guy and they beat up somebody. No, but I don't know if they had planned to attack him or I, frankly, because then they turned on me. They threw me over. So I was sitting down. They threw me to, so I was prone, and they were kicking and hitting me for, I don't know, 15 minutes or something.
15 minutes. Jeez.
10, 15 minutes. My friend Seth DeBachman actually has a cartoon about it. He's rather a famous cartoonist in New York. Political cartoonist, and he wrote something called What I Saw because he was across the street watching the whole thing. And they kicked and hit me and just continued and continued. And then the police in marked cars came and arrested me after that. And it was rather interesting. I spent 24 hours in jail.
Let me get this straight. You got arrested for being beaten up by the cops.
No, that's not what they said. They always cover it up.
Oh
They arrested
yeah.
me.
So what could they possibly have said, like invented, like to as an excuse to arrest you then?
Yeah, they first charged me, I think it was with felony assault on a police officer, which they knew they were getting anywhere with that later charged it to felony riot. Although no riot ever happened, but that I organized some riot, which was the police protest, I guess. But the interesting thing was that when I read the complaint against me with my lawyer, and he, you know, actually we were working well together because he took me seriously and let me help formulate some of my defense, because he actually felt, and it's true, that I had more experience in criminal defense than he did, which didn't mean that he doesn't have a lot, but I've done death penalty defense, et cetera, et cetera. So I have the background. And the interesting thing was, when I read the criminal complaint, it said nothing illegal that I'd done. You know, he actually, you know, read it like, you know, you see anything illegal in it? I'm like, no, actually. Like, so they were so moronic that they didn't even come up with something, you know, make up something that I'd done which was illegal. Because I didn't do anything illegal, but normally in something like that, they would say something that I'd done, you know? And they kept dragging me into court. You know, they have to bring me to court within 6 months, and they waited until that time to finally bring me to a grand jury, because you have to be charged by it before you have to go to trial on a felony or a serious crime. And in the meantime, actually, a couple of months after that, I'd left town because I had some work to do outside of town for a while. And I'd left keys with housemates. And I tried to get back into my place. When I came back, I'd already paid my rent and all that. And they wouldn't answer my text, answer my phone calls, whatever. So I rolled over there one night to get to the place where I'd been sleeping. I've been back in town for a week and not able to sleep. And my I left keys with them because I thought, you know, I thought I might be gone for a couple of months. And if so, I wanted people who were in town for Occupy or whatever to be able to have a place to sleep. And then when I was in there, the police showed up and arrested me for breaking a metal door. It was kind of in a rundown neighborhood, and there's a lot of really heavy metal doors that are, you know, solid steel and all that. And I had sandals on, but they arrested me for kicking the door to the point where it was completely broken. What? I even told them, what? I got sandals on. What do you mean? You know, I couldn't have possibly done that. But anyway, so they arrested me. And at that point, they even told me that they would have just given me a citation and let me go. But because of this other thing pending, they took me to jail for another 24 hours. Okay? Both of these charges, once it got to a grand jury and I testified in front of the grand jury, they dismissed the charges because there was nothing there and obviously hadn't done anything. Okay? But on the same day that the charges for the door-related case were dismissed, somehow the prosecution had a warrant, a felony warrant, for my arrest issued for me based upon a case which was already dismissed. Okay? Mm-hmm. Months after that, I had work in Virginia. And they just stopped me at one point, just, you know, asked me for ID, I don't know, randomly, kind of. And I gave them my ID. And they arrested me because I had a felony warrant out of New York. And I was in jail. They threw me in jail for days and days. My father had to put up $5,000 bail, which is gone. Because the overall bail they put on me was $50,000 for basically for, I don't know, criminal mischief for a door. Which is, wow, that's a pretty high, seems like a pretty high bail for a door to me. But it seems that it was for political reasons they put that high on me. In fact, when the prosecutor had called New York, New York had actually asked for them not to set any bail on me and to leave me in there until whenever the New York police decided to pick me up.
Absolutely dreadful.
When I got out that day, when I got out of jail, the judge told me that I could not leave Virginia, but that within Virginia, the New York City police had 10 days to come and pick me up. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So 10 days later, and, you know, I'm being away from my fiance, children, whatever. I can't go anywhere. I'm stuck in Virginia. At that point, I no longer had a job, so I'm just stuck in Virginia, staying at hotels and whatever. All right, so I go into court 10 days later thinking, cool, this is all back. Now I'll go back to New York and deal with this crap. Okay, but I couldn't before that. Now, when I went in front of the judge, he told me, what are you doing here? You had 10 days to go and deal with your warrant in New York. I even had paperwork that said that I could not leave the state of Virginia. But he told me that I violated my conditions by staying in Virginia. And I said, what do you mean? I'm sorry. What? And he said, well, I told you that you had to go to New York and deal with it. I'm like, no, you didn't. I'm sorry. And at that point, I was nervous and angry. And he said, oh, wow, you seem a little bit, you know, worked up. Maybe you're on drugs. I said, what? I don't do drugs. What are you talking about? So he first of all told me that I was arrested and that he was going to keep me. It was like a Thursday. He was going to keep me until Tuesday for the police to come and get me from New York again. And I said, but wait, you're arresting me for following what I'm supposed to, like, what? You know, it really seemed like I was, you know, in the book Catch-22, you know, what do I do? I felt so helpless and confused, and they arrested me, took me back in the cell, gave me a piss test for four different substances. I don't even remember what they are. The first one tested falsely positive, so thankfully they gave me three because I don't do drugs, and I got tested as negative. And at that, the judge brought me back. You know, he told me that I was going to be staying in jail until the police came and picked me up, and he let me go. And in a humorous way, he was like, well, you know, this time, you know, you're supposed to go back to New York and deal with it, you know, just like I told you last time, which he didn't. And yeah, so basically at that point, I was able to get out and go home. And when I went home, because all this had gone down, my lawyer was able to go in front of a grand jury by himself without me even being there. And cleared the warrant because I was being arrested for something I'd already been cleared for. I was being arrested, there was no crime at all. You know, so the warrant was the crime, but it was a warrant based upon nothing. You know, and basically the whole thing has been completely terrifying. Knowing I am being singled out, and unfortunately, since I've been attacked, I haven't been back to Occupy at all. They've been successful in that. Because I realize at this point, if I were to go back, that he likely would murder me. And I'm not interested. So I can't really be part of Occupy anymore because I know that all these things combined. The arrest to start with, but then this warrant thing, it's like, no, huh? They, you know, are singling me out.
And so they've terrorized you.
Absolutely, the prosecution.
And used you as an example, basically, because you were standing up for the rights of the Occupy protesters, you've ended up being I don't want to say victim, but you've been victimized for those circumstances.
Yeah, well, I mean, it goes beyond that, too, because it's the level to which the whole thing was orchestrated. Because I've come to know through speaking with my lawyer that the head prosecutor had met with the head of the police department and the head of the police. It's like something like a union for police, Benevolent Officers Association, it's called, and that they were the ones who were making me be prosecuted because the prosecutor who was on the case looked over everything and had told the head prosecutor that I think we should drop this case because there's nothing there. But because they were leaned on from the powers that be, they continued with the persecution and the prosecution. And so it all came from up top. And when it came from up top, and considering the violent arrests at Sukati Park and the continued, you know, random pepper spraying, et cetera, I realized this is huge, man. You know, and this is something they would just take me out in an alley and shoot me. You know, there's no two ways when you've got, the army of the New York City Police Department is 80,000 people. When you've got that against one person.
Can you detail to us what injuries you received as a result of being beaten up? And can you tell us, were the hospital were they good at providing evidence, or did you have any trouble with that?
No, I'm going to get the hospital records, and my lawyer is going to get it. It's not a problem. I went to the emergency room. I got out of jail 9, 10 o'clock at night, and then I had to go collect my things from the precinct where they brought me at first. So I wasn't out of there until after midnight. So I went home and went to sleep on the first day, you know, as soon as I got out. So I didn't go to the hospital till the next morning. Okay. When I was in there, but I went there because I couldn't see straight. I felt horrible. And I wasn't sure if I had a concussion, what, you know. And I was diagnosed with a concussion there. They told me that if I felt dizzy or if I felt odd, that I should go back to an emergency room. Well, a few hours after I was let out of the emergency room, I did feel such a way. And I went back to a different emergency room. And at this emergency room, they said that I had had a severe concussion and that, you know, it was incredibly bad. And one of the problems that I had was they gave me an eye chart. You know, like you get an optometrist. I couldn't read a damn thing. You know, I couldn't. I mean, you know, the top letters were blurry as heck. And I had LASIK surgery some years ago. So I've had, perfect vision since then. And for months, I couldn't see properly at all. It was horrible, you know. As a result of the concussion, basically they kicked me so hard that it severely affected my eyesight.
That's absolutely horrendous. It's obviously had a very profound, and understandably had a very profound effect on you.
Yeah, well,
and
I mean,
I can hear that from what you're saying. I can hear it in your voice, and I can't emphasize how important it is that. That these kind of experiences that people are having are getting out, like experiences like yourself about police brutality, because if it doesn't get exposed, if people don't talk about it and it gets swept under the carpet, nothing is ever going to happen about it. To write it.
But that's really the thing, they all related incidents, and with this in particular, with what happened to me, that wasn't isolated. The whole thing from start to finish was very coordinated. So it's not some rogue whatever. I mean, in fact, actually, even the squad who brutalized me, I've never seen them before. I'm a New Yorker. I've never seen them before. I don't know who the heck they were. Apparently, they were some sort of investigative unit or something. That's all I know about them. And, you know, having been at protests for a long time, you know, for a long time, it's weird. There's some force out there, some part of the force, sorry, that I don't know who the heck they are. I've heard the same from with regard to Sakati Park. Okay. People tried to get through to me that night, but I'd gone home to sleep and my phone was off. So I wasn't actually there when the eviction occurred. Okay? But from everybody I've known who was there, everybody told me that that was a special, you know, kick the head in squad. You know, these weren't regular police officers. None of them who were there at work, regular police officers. They were a specific squad which is called out to kick the crap out of people. You know, and in this case, it seems that these officers were similar. You know, and part of the scary thing is, okay, the NYPD is big enough, but I don't know how big this is. I don't know who it's actually from, do I? Is it from just the NYPD? Is it from higher than that? You know, but within that, I'm not alone in that. You know, I'm not the only person. And I think you also have to contemplate that if they're doing that to the people who are legally there to speak with, you know, to deal with them legally, and somebody who's there to protect people and their rights, if they're doing that because I'm a lawyer, well, what are they thinking about the regular protesters then? Why bit of all witnesses before they do?
So, Alexander, what happens now, basically, because obviously you've been cleared of these charges, what are you going to take further action?
Yeah, well, right now, I should email my lawyer in the next couple of days. I was to have, we have this problem in the United States. It's where within a city, if you have police brutality charges, they have these review committees, which are pretty much comprised of police, that you are supposed to file papers with them so they could deal with it internally. And you have, you know, some places 6 months, some places a year to file those before you file a lawsuit. But the whole reason for it is to basically have people not sue the police to, you know, be unable to because they didn't go through this procedure. Because it's not the first thing you think of. All right, well, you know, I got brutalized by the police. I think I'll go to the police and report it. You know, it doesn't come to mind, if you will. Well, I did because I went to a lawyer here who told me, all right, we need to file this thing, right? And thankfully, at this point, actually about the Door case and how that was a false arrest, the review committee picked it up. So we had a court date, but I was incredibly ill at the time, so I couldn't go. But we have a future court date just for their internal review of what happened with the false warrant, et cetera, as part of that. So that's a good foundation, if you will. In the longer term, I definitely plan on suing the police because partially because, you know, it's not just for me. As somebody who became a lawyer because I'm political, and I felt I was doing a lot of work for political prisoners, and I felt I could do more as a lawyer than I can as writing them letters, which I think is important too, don't get me wrong. But, you know, because of that, in that class, as it were, as a political lawyer, I don't want them to be able to do this to any political lawyer. I don't want them to be able to do it for anybody for political reasons. And I feel that if I don't sue them, and at least hit financially hard, that they just have complete and utter free reign, which they do to a degree anyway. But I feel that if I didn't do something proactive against that, I would be rubber stamp, you know, I would be giving them permission, essentially, you know. And in that way, yeah, I definitely plan on pursuing that, and I would like to hopefully, you know, once I win the civil action, I will do all I can as well, even though New York City police, unless they, you know, write things on the internet about going and murdering and eating a bunch of people, which happened recently, don't get prosecuted, but at least I'm going to do my best to make sure, or to make that a possibility. I would like to bring criminal charges against all of them because they are all criminals. You know, violent felons, basically. So, you know, so yeah, those are my plans in the near future. And unfortunately, also understanding the politics around New York City, if I do win, and I win a fair amount of money, I'll leave. I won't stay around New York City because at that point, I would be absolutely shocked, honestly, if I weren't murdered. I would expect that they would come and kill me if I go and win a civil action against them.
You it's know, absolutely dreadful, but yet horrifically not surprising in this day and age, because they see you as a threat, because you're very knowledgeable and you understand their legal system and all this legalese, and you can talk your way around it, and they think that a threat. That's in no way excuse for what they've done to you is absolutely horrific, and they really should be brought to justice for that. So yeah, I'm glad that you came on to talk about this. And also, do you have is there any way that people can help you with your case or donate, or I don't know, is there any way that people could?
If anybody knows anybody around the world in the media who would help to get the story out, there may be costs associated with it, but I don't really have it anything set up for that. People can feel free to get in touch with me via my website at globallaw.com. And outside of that, even if you're not in the media, so to speak, as you are, or in a newspaper, whatever, let people know. You know, if you're listening to this now and you have, you know, a link to show, to have other people listen, to hear what's going on, I think that that's extremely important. You know, and the one thing to know between the UK and the US, one thing in living in both places, is the reverence of toward the police is much, much higher in the United States. Where I've had friends who say, well, you know, sometimes in a protest, if you get in a scuffle with the cop and they hit you, you hit them, the criminal the criminal outcome may be rather similar. Here we have special laws that if you hit a cop, then it's a much more serious crime. And the whole thing, this deification, I would say, where they're not people, they're gods. That's one thing which I'm happy, and I have the utmost respect for the grand juries that I spoke in front of, that they were able to look at me as a human being, not somebody lesser than what the police said. Because most of this country, the vast majority outside of New York City, a cop could say, well, you know, he flew down from a building and hit me in the face. And because cops saying it, so, you know, all right, sure, he probably just flew down from that building, you know, or whatever. Something just, my point is something completely outrageous because the police said it, although there's plenty of evidence out there that, you know, have classes on how to lie.
Yeah.
But at the same point, not looked at as equals.
Yeah, I'm afraid we're actually going to have to finish up now. This just flew in. We probably could have talked for another hour. But thanks for coming on, Alexander, and sharing with us your information. Because without having shed light on this, many of us would not have had any idea about the depth of the corruption that was going on within certain elements of the police force. All we can do really is, as you say, keep pushing this information out there so that people become aware of it, so it gets the exposure that it deserves. Because it's very clear that there's corruption and at so many levels with a lot of people. And as Edmund Burke says, I think it's Edmund Burke, all it takes for evil to prevail is that good people do nothing. Do you have any final words just very quickly before we finish?
Yeah, I would say that the one thing to you know, keep in your head, in your mind, is no matter what they do, no matter what insane laws they pass, no matter what, that when we stand together for what is correct and what is right and what is compassionate, that we have to just keep doing that. Because for ourselves and also for our kids, our grandkids, whatever, we have to be able to look at each other eye to eye. And as long as we have the elite, the rich, the powerful, looking down at us little pawns as anything other than a complete and utter equal to them. And not complete and utter, why are you my equal, but hey, that's cool. We have serious problems and we have to stand up. And that's why I think the context of concept of Occupy is something that should continue in every aspect of our lives. And yet there are ramifications because they want there to be serious ramifications for those who stand up for what is just and what is correct. But no matter what are we here for? What are we doing on this planet other than standing up for each other and standing up for what's right and just being good people?
Excellent, excellent. For more information on our links from tonight's guests, please check the video description for tonight's show tomorrow. You can find them on Dark City Radio on YouTube or Dark City Dawn. Please keep in touch, Alexander, and you're welcome to come back on any time to update us on your situation with your court action. Thanks to all who listened tonight. This was Dawn's Diorama. So until next time, good night.